We've talked about the medieval period and the effects of Christianity upon medieval Christendom, the rise of Western civilization under the gospel, unimpeded by Greek and Roman thought for a good little period of time, several hundred years, where they weren't being bothered by that. But that begins to change. And to talk about that change, we have to kind of back up and talk about, if you've got knowledge that comes from the Greek period, how was it being preserved? Well, it had been written down. It was deposited in libraries all over the Greek world, the Roman world, and so forth. And some of these libraries were great. Some of them were small. But there was a lot of destruction that took place when the barbarians came through. Many of the libraries were burned down. Some had burned down earlier. How Alexandria burned is, one of those things that's open for discussion, but more than likely it burned during the Roman Civil War when Julius Caesar was trying to defend his hold on Alexandria. He burned all of his ships, and there was a version of it that the fires from his ships set Alexandria on fire and burned the library as well. There are other burnings of the Alexandrian Library, which was one of the greatest of the libraries. There was a basement in Alexandrian Library. There was a lot of works that were preserved there. There were other libraries round about. There's talk about the Muslims having destroyed libraries. They might have, but one thing is for sure, that as the Umayyad dynasty of the Islamic Arabs was taking over the Middle East, North Africa, all the way to their conquest of Iberia, which we know today as Spain, that all of this knowledge, these books and so forth, fell in their hands. Now, not everything that was written fell into their hands. Only a very small portion of all of the classical literature fell into their hands. We don't even know what the percentages are here, how much was actually preserved. But from the standpoint of providence, we have to understand that what we know about the Greeks and what we know about their beliefs and what we know about ancient history is what was preserved from all this corpus of writing that had been done in ancient times. That which survived into the modern time is what we have for the interpretation of ancient history. Which, if that's all we had, if we didn't have any kind of a standard to go by, then we would have no clue what happened in ancient times, really, or we'd have very little knowledge of that. And we wouldn't really even know how important the Greek and Asian, Near Eastern thought and things like this, how important it was in the civilizations they were in. I mean, how would we know that Socrates wasn't just a nutcase and nobody paid any attention to him? And the reason why Plato's books survived was because they were down in the basement of the library because nobody ever read them. I mean, we wouldn't have any idea about all of these things if we didn't have a standard to go by. And the standard, of course, is Scripture. And that informs us more about what people actually thought and what events took place. And interestingly enough, in early scholastics of ancient history, the Bible was absolutely necessary to use as an anchor for studying the writings in ancient civilization, because if you couldn't find some correlation in the Bible, then you didn't know where you were. So one of the most interesting things is that the Bible with its strict genealogies and so forth, gave a timeline of history that was adhered to very, very strictly. And what we know of as antiquities today is built upon that biblical version of ancient history by people like Bishop Usher and others. And the departure from the Bible by historians, by modern historians, is an interesting thing to me, because what they're departing from is the thing that gave them the ability to say anything of any significance about ancient history in the first place. I mean, we would know nothing about ancient history if it had not been tied to the chronologies of Scripture. Now, they think today that we've got other standards to go by, but those are being questioned constantly. But the Bible was the guide for what to do with works of literature in antiquities for a long time, and it was necessary to use the Bible for those things. So it's a kind of a betrayal against the discipline itself to try to cut the Bible out of it. And you can only do that after you've gotten the good use out of it, right? And that's not going to work, and it's not working. If I have a chance to later, we'll talk about in criticism. Maybe we'll talk about how it is that the Bible and its place in history and in thought and so forth is beginning to become essential all over again. But anyway, as the Muslims made their way across in their conquest, this literature began to fall into their hands. They probably destroyed some of it, some of their what would you call them? Islamic fundamentalists probably destroyed some of it. For the most part, though, as much as they could, they kept it and collected it, put it in libraries of their own, and even translated it over into the Arabic language, which was a good language vehicle for a lot of Middle Eastern thought. Arabic was not that much different from Aramaic, so therefore it was a nice translation over into a good complex language that could hold all of these thoughts. So it fell into the Arabs' hands, and it had an effect on civilizing the Arabic Empire, the Umayyad, the Abbasid empires, before the Seljuk Turks began to dominate Islam later on. So that's how it was preserved, and they studied it. Amalgamated some of their thought, some of this classical thought into Islam, studied the science. They were particularly interested in the sciences that were put forth by the classics, and things about geography were useful to them, things about astronomy, optics, magnetism, lots of other things that were real important to them, and that they began to philosophize on themselves. Now all this is going on down in Arab territory, but that's going on around the Mediterranean. And right at the turn of the millennium, a few things happened. One was the First Crusade, which happened, I think, 1050 or something like that. The First Crusade took place, and Christendom moved into the Middle East, taking over the Holy Land, controlling that, and then some contact began to take place between them and the Muslims. It was, you know, adversarial at first, but you know, later it became more and more friendly. That also cut out of the Mediterranean trade the Rathenite Jews. The Rathenite Jews were very much in control of the Mediterranean trade from about the second or third century up to the First Crusade. And the Rathenite Jews actually controlled the Mediterranean and the silk and spice routes, which had been controlled by all kinds of nations for a long time. The Crusades knocked the Rathenite Jews out, who basically moved over to Poland and started banking. But for a while, they were the ones in control. When they start, when their control in of trade into Europe ceased, then it was taken over by those Christian countries down there in the south of Europe. And, of course, naturally, mainly the one that juts the furthest out into the Mediterranean, which was Italy. And so Italian trade began very early. It began around the first of the first millennium, the 11th century. And when this happened, then Christian merchants began to have contact with Arabic merchants. And these were friendly relations because they were business relations. In spite of the fact that Christians and Muslims were fighting each other over in Turkey and in the Middle East, the merchants were more friendly to one another and talked to one another and shared ideas with one another. And a lot of those ideas, a lot of those classical ideas began to leach into the south of Europe through these merchant contacts that were going on. And then in 1085, the Spanish had already begun to try to take over their territory again from the Arabic people who had been controlling Spain for a long period of time. And they managed to conquer Spain, reconquer Spain, and push the Arabs out. As many of them as they pushed out, who went across Gibraltar and into North Africa. And when they did, they took over Toledo. And the reason why I point Toledo out to you is because in Toledo was probably the biggest of all the Arabic libraries. And it housed almost all of what we know of classical material. It was in there, all in Arabic. And so from 1085 onward, scholars were going into Toledo. Christian scholars were going into Toledo. They were pulling out these works of Plato and Ptolemy and Galen and so on and so on and so on, and started translating all of these into Latin. And so you go from whatever their language was, Greek or Latin or whatever, into Arabic and then into Latin. So right off the bat, we can see there's going to be some textual problems here because of the passage, you know, not only the continual copies of these, but also the passage of them through these languages. There's going to be problems with that. So when we get into the effects of modern thought on biblical criticism, we'll come back to that, all right, because, you know, it's much easier to trust the Bible and its so-called textual variations than it is to trust the classical material, because it's passed through a lot of hands, very radical hands, to come down to us today. And how accurate they are to their originals, nobody knows. Nobody knows at all. So, for instance, I mean, if you're going to read about Thucydides' Peloponnesian Wars, how do you know you're really reading what Thucydides wrote? Because it's gone through hundreds and hundreds of years, passed through so many hands, gone from one language to another to get to us today. You know, it's real easy for everybody to say, well, we can't trust the Bible because, you know, Matthew is spelled with two T's sometimes and one T another. And yet we trust Julius Caesar's Civil War, you know, which was written somewhere around 100 B.C. or 80 B.C. or something like that, and has gone through so many different hands to get to us today. That's a different story. But the bottom line is that these thoughts, all of these things we've been building up to this point, Milesian philosophy, the Sophist schools of thought, the school of Athens, the schools, the Epicurean Stoic schools that come up afterwards, has all been preserved up to the 11th century in this way. And that, now it begins to come into Europe. Starting in the 11th century, it starts to flood more and more into Europe. And it's going to have a big effect on European thinking. Interestingly enough, all this is going on in a more concentrated form in South Europe. So as we get into the period of the Reformation, Renaissance, and all of those things, then what we're going to be dealing with there is a difference between Northern and Southern Europe. How the prevailing thought in Southern Europe is going to be so different from that in Northern Europe. In Southern Europe, you have a strong strain of humanism. In Northern Europe, you have a much better ground here for the Reformation to take place. More strict orthodoxy, a much better place for preserving doctrinal and theological knowledge. So, through the merchants, as the merchants have had contact with the Arabs, these things take place. Marco Polo, very early in the High Middle Age period, we see in his story and others like that a concentration of power because of a concentration of money taking place in northern Italy. The Hanseatic League is in northern Italy. It has a massive influence over all of Europe. The House of de' Medici is a big banking house that's beginning to rise up there, which is actually financing wars all over Europe. And at the height of the Medici family, they're actually going to be buying popes and putting them in office. So they are very, very powerful. And they're also going to be the patrons of arts during the Renaissance. Now, before the Renaissance took place in the 15th century, there was a Renaissance that took place around the 11th, 12th centuries. And it probably was an even more important Renaissance. This Renaissance is what we call the Scholastics, or some call it the Schoolmen. And what this was it was, and those who participated in it were both Arabic and European. So you're going to see a lot of Arabic names mixed together with a lot of European names, because here's where the concentrations of these discussions and studies and so forth around the classical material and the old scientific material take place. And this was a big movement that took place in South Europe, the Schoolmen movement, the Scholastic movement that took place there. And there are three periods to the Scholastic movement. The first period is what we call the Platonist period, and that lasted from about the 9th to the 12th centuries. Some of the characters who are involved there you might recognize. Alcuin, who was very close to Charlemagne, and he was one of the earliest of the Schoolmen. John Scotus Erigena, Anselm, even a Pope, Sylvester II, Lanfranc, who was the Archbishop of Canterbury, Pierre Lombard. You see that not only do you have merchants here, nobles involved in this, but also churchmen are involved in this as well. So this is not something that is antithetical to the church. The church is beginning to embrace this knowledge more and more. They don't mind if their clergy is studying classical philosophy. And the more that do that, you know, as we see, here's a pope who is involved in classical philosophy. And that's going to have a big effect on the church going forward. You know, remember what we said in the early Middle Ages, the Roman Catholic Church, even though it was beginning to diverge in a number of areas, as long as it was theologically Augustinian, it was still a church, it was still spreading the gospel, and it still was having a salt and light influence on Europe and some of the other countries round about as well. But as we enter into the Schoolmen period, then we see some leaven starting to enter into the church, and it's going to shift its emphasis in doctrine further and further away from its orthodox roots, and begin to move away from Augustinianism until it's finally going to land on what's called Thomistic theology, which is named after Thomas Aquinas. And he's one of the schoolmen as well. All right. So this is what we're this is where the Catholic Church is going. It's beginning to come off course and head towards the influences of old Greek thought. The second period, or what's called the Golden Age, is an Aristotelian period. The discovery of Aristotelianism. This is much more interesting to the schoolmen because it stresses the particularity of things. And they're very interested in science. These are very scientific-like people. They're interested in astronomy, in earth science, and all of the particulars of science. And not only that, but the rendering of science, the application of science. We're entering into a period here, which is the 13th and 14th centuries, where these first come along right here. And why? Because of the rediscovery of optics that takes place in Europe from the Arabs, who get that from the Greeks. And so glasses, and as we know, later field glasses, telescopes. And that's going to change the way Europeans see the universe. So these are going to have some pretty profound effects upon thought going forward. And then the third period is what's called the nominalist period. And it goes all the way to the 17th century. And really, I think by the time we get here, we're entering into the Enlightenment. So I'm just going to leave that part off. I don't think that's really a schoolman period. I think it's just part of the Enlightenment period. We're well into the Enlightenment period by the time we get there. Magnetism, optics. This is when the clock is invented. Ideas on spontaneous generation. How to do experimentation, which is the way they overturned spontaneous generation, was to do experimentation that disproved it. Science in its earliest stage is beginning to rise up during this period of time. And that's very, the power of science is what is going to have the biggest effect on everybody. It's kind of scary. Because by the time Galileo points his field glasses to the moon and starts telling them this is not what you've always said it was, then the church is going to go, whoa, this is very powerful here. We've got to be careful about this, because it's going to overturn an awful lot of the medieval synthesis. And if you overturn the medieval synthesis, then you overturn the reasonings for power that the Roman Catholic Church has always claimed. And so you don't want to mess everything up too quickly. And so there is a certain degree of suppression that takes place, which I think is overblown by modern historians, that the church and religion and Christianity has always been against science and against knowledge. That was never the point. The point had to do mostly with the feeling that that the system was going to get disrupted and torn too fast at a time when it would have been extremely dangerous for that to take place. By the time Galileo comes along, there are a lot of dangers confronting Europe, and you've got the Mongol hordes to the east. You've got the Seljuk Turks who are continually putting pressure on Europe. There are plagues that are starting to take place. The medieval climate optimum has come to an end by 1315. Life is starting to get harder and harder. People are losing confidence in their authority structures and so forth. So this is not the time to go changing the whole system. All right. I'm not saying I agree with them. I'm just simply saying there was some actual practical sense to trying to suppress some of these fast changes. However, the Roman Catholic Church was not against classical knowledge. They were not against classical knowledge. They embraced classical knowledge. They actually embraced the Enlightenment. And I'm not saying that to their credit, because it would have been better for the world if that classical knowledge had remained buried and never come back again. But that was not God's will, probably because he wanted to bring it to the attention of the church for several centuries so that we could deal with it and destroy it. We haven't finished yet, but that's what we're supposed to do. And I'm not talking about destroying the books. I mean destroying the basis of the knowledge, basically, you know, disproving the whole thing as we get to know the scriptures better and better. It is a profound time. Let me show you how profound it is. Sometime in the 13th century, I'm going to have to make up the story because it happened. We know it happened because we see the result of what happened, but we don't know exactly who it was, where it was, or exactly how it happened. But it happened. And here's what happened. Some monk kept missing his matins. You know, he slept right through them. That's, you know, you have several prayers that you're supposed to do if you're a monk. You've sworn to God that you're going to do all of these prayers, and there was one somewhere who was sleeping through them. And, of course, when you sleep through your matins and break your oath, you've got to go to the priest, and you've got to do confession and ask forgiveness of sins and do a whole bunch of penance, and it's just extremely time-consuming. And so some monk decided he was going to have to do something somehow or another to get himself out of bed and get himself to his prayers at the proper time so he could quit breaking his oath, quit going to confession, and quit having to do all this restitution. So what he did was he invented himself a little machine. And this little machine was simply a deadfall machine that went around in a circle and with a gear that would stop on a verge escapement, and it would stop and stop and stop, and then finally a lever would come around, bang, hit a bell, and when it hit the bell, it was time for him to get up and go pray. Problem solved. He is a dedicated Christian from this point on because he has now invented the timer. Well, once you invent the timer, you have all the mechanism that you need for inventing a clock. And that was the beginning of the invention of the mechanical clock. It took place sometime in the 13th century. It was done in a monastery because the earliest ones are monastery timers that are used for clocking out, you know, the various prayers that needed to be done. Some of them are still extant. Off of that idea right there, the mechanical clock was invented. And Europe just literally went wild over clocks. I mean, that was the thing. It was the computer of its day. Not everybody could have one, but every town could if they could raise up enough money to have a town clock. And clockworks did all kinds of things. Not only did they keep time, but you could put all kinds of faces on them to give you sidereal time, to give you the motion of the planets, the phases of the moon, all of the festivals of the Roman Catholic Church, and then you could have a little Punch and Judy show come out and do some things, you know, and mark off time with all kinds of nice musical things going on. And the quintessential of all this was the 14th century Augsburg clock, which people actually used to travel from all over Europe just to see that clock in action, because it had so much action involved to it that it was just amazing what they could do. This had a really profound effect on the way Europeans thought going into the Enlightenment period. And we'll pick up on that theme later when we get to Montaigne and Fontenelle. because the clockwork's idea is going to be the leading principle on how they see the future of the world and how they think that the world is operating. So all of these things have a great effect. Magnetism, making a compass, made it possible for men to begin to now navigate on across the ocean. And so the discovery of the new world is sort of hinging on this little piece of knowledge that comes up out of these Arabic libraries from classical times. Now, if the impact of these kinds of things was that profound, how much more would the ideas be, the Platonic ideas, the Aristotelian ideas? How much play would those have as well? And you don't see much of it in Northern Europe, but in Southern Europe, it's getting more and more profound all the time. So what you have is the beginnings of an Aristotelian and a Platonic Christianity amalgam. And this contributes to the Benedictine reforms that take place. The Benedictines, as we've said, started out as a highly evangelical monastic movement, which did great things to Christianize Europe in its earliest stages. But as the Benedictine movement gets older and older, they begin to have such an influence over Europe that they're now, almost all of the popes, by the time you reach the High Middle Ages, are now Benedictines. And these popes are beginning to become men who are more and more influenced, popes, cardinals, archbishops, more and more influenced by the schumann knowledge that they're beginning to pick up from classical literature and so forth. So that these ideas are getting into are beginning to leaven down their ideas, and they're not so Christian anymore. They're more philosophical now. And by the time you get to the High Middle Ages, the Benedictine movement has ground down into a philosophical movement for the most part, and brings about what's called the reform of the Roman Catholic Church. And so the Roman Catholic Church begins to move further and further away from its old Christian roots. You know, we spent a lot of time talking about how we got to the classical philosophical age through the mythological systems that came about before them. It's a passage between true knowledge, which men had in the very beginning, true knowledge that was being preserved by patriarchs, and later by the written word, and that true knowledge being perverted into primordial mythologies developing into archaeo-pagan mythologies, the reversal of these old pagan mythologies into neo-pagan mythology, and then the mythologies beginning to morph into Milesian philosophy and Milesian natural philosophy. And the schools of Milesian philosophy passing through the Sophist period into the School of Athens, and from the School of Athens into the City of Man. And so you have all this thought that comes out of human considerations on unreality. Let's make sure that we get back to that. Because what is mythology? Mythology is irrationality. It's unreality. It is a war against God and against God's thoughts. God's thoughts are true. They're only true. God's reality is real. That includes his spiritual reality, the reality of heaven, and it also the terrestrial reality, the reality of earth. All of his reality is real. Spiritual reality, corporeal, physical reality, it's all reality as God has created it to be, as He presents it to us, as He presents it to our senses, as He presents it to our interpretations through our senses. The world that God has made is what it is. And as long as we know that, then we know something about God through general revelation. You can read the first volume of Calvin's Institutes to find out just how profound a thing general revelation can be, how much you can actually know from Romans chapter 1 of God through general revelation. You can't know salvation, but you can know an awful lot. And so this is continually reminding men of who God is, who it is who has created him, and he in his sin, who does not love God but is an enemy of God, wants to escape from that. He's always trying to escape from it. And the only place that he can escape from it is through unreality. And so this is where all of this string of thought processes comes from, is a pursuit of unreality. In this is a great poison, a poison that destroys civilizations. The destruction of the city of man is brought about as much by the classical philosophy that fuels it as anything else. And when the classical philosophy was buried for a few hundred years and couldn't be found, Christian civilization flourished during that period. And now what's happening? Christian Europe is now beginning to bite the old apple, which has all of these attractive qualities to it, like magnetism and optics and various aspects of science that are very useful to us. You know, how to use gunpowder and render it to knock over castle walls and stuff like that, which you had to do all kinds of wild and bizarre things to do that in earlier times. Now you can just punch holes in it. I mean, there's just lots of fun things involved in this classical knowledge. But also underneath that candy coating is the poison that destroyed civilizations. The thought poison that just destroyed the Roman Empire, the Greek Empire, Persian Empire, all of these things. They ate that poison. They died of it. And now Western civilization has found that apple and is starting to munch on it. And so when we began to take in this classical knowledge, then what we essentially did was we committed ourselves once again to being poisoned. And if we continue along that line, which we have, and we're well advanced in it, then it's going to kill our civilization. And Western civilization is very nearly dead. That which began so well, I mean, think about it. What our roots were, those black soil roots of Germania and Christianity entering into those roots and fast starting, kicking up the great plant of Western civilization, of Christendom. And now we're going back to the apple. We're going back to that same thing that killed the civilization that set us free. And we're becoming that civilization all over again. We are dying of the same poison in our mental processes, in our philosophies. And it's going to get into everything that we do. It gets into our how we see the world and in our decision-making processes. Even is going to affect our sciences, the precision of our science, the precision of our mathematics. It's going to take away from us any idea of certainty that Christianity gives to us. So that's one of the nice things about Christianity and its absolutism, is that it gives us certainty. We can know a thing for certain. We don't have to be questioning whether or not whether or not I exist, or whether or not you exist, or whether or not we see things the way they really are, as we're going to see in relativism, these old Hindu problems of monism. We don't have those problems. The world is what God made it to be. And it is what God made it to be, not because we observe it, but because God tells us it is. Because He's the one who observes it as it really is from the outside. And so we can trust our senses because He made our senses appropriately to perceive the environment of the world that He made us to be in. And we can trust our interpretation of our senses because He made our minds to reason out the things that our senses perceive about the world that we live in. It all fits. It fits because God has created us. And we can believe in that. We don't have to doubt our existence and the existence of all things. So as long as we hold on to that, because we have the certainty of Scripture here to continually reassure us of these things, then we'll be fine. I mean, we can keep a straight course going. But as soon as we begin to eat that apple, what happens? Our eyes start getting bleary-eyed. It's just like Eve all over again. She finds herself peering into a whole different reality, a reality in which chaos rules. Good evil is so admixed together that it can't be distinguished from one another. And that is the world that Eve peered into, and it's the world that we're beginning to re-enter in our time in history right now. So this is the reintroduction, the resurrection of classical thought as it begins to come back into Europe again. As we get into the next section, we'll see how it develops. We'll take a look at how it develops in Europe and the conflicts that rise up between that and the church, because the church is not going to sit still on this thing. However, if the church is going to rise up against it, it's not going to be the Roman Catholic Church that does it. So God is going to do something to His church right on time to meet this enemy that's coming in.